Chief Justice.
Saying good morning is not prohibited.
Good morning.
Dover's a friendly town.
Even though I get to go second, I thought I would do the introductions from our side of the table. At table is the General Counsel for Klein Heights Capital Partners, Andrew Rosell. Klein Heights is the managing fund of the plaintiffs in this case.
Welcome.
Also at table are Lynn Porterfield and Paul Brown from my office.
Welcome. Well, Lynn's no stranger.
Morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce my colleagues seated with me at council table. From my office, Margot Alex, and from Aiken Gump, Samid Guha, and Monica Duda.
Welcome to the court.
May I proceed, Chief Justice?
Yes, please.
Your Honors, the opinion below is an example of a fundamental problem with appraisal litigation, which has been described by the Court of Chancery as a surreal world. Both sides in this case hired experts who were well-qualified and who the Court of Chancery referred to as well-qualified. Yet the experts arrived at conclusions that were $51 per share apart. In this case, that translates into a difference of about $2 billion. The court heard 4 days of testimony, largely devoted to both sides' experts trying to predict the future, trying to predict the volatility of gold and stock, trying to predict how much more stocks will return over bonds over a period of decades, if not centuries, trying to predict the future of the Russian economy in general and the Russian telecommunications industry in particular, trying to predict Golden's long-term growth rate, not only for the next 5 years, not only for the next 10 years, but into perpetuity. The court then wrote a 51-page opinion in which it acknowledged that the valuation it arrived at was imperfect. It acknowledged that any estimation of the equity risk premium, which is a major issue in this case, was something that was highly uncertain. And the court also said on page 42 of the opinion, "This battle of experts is one that I am poorly positioned to resolve, and it appears unlikely that a finance professor would fare any better." But the court did attempt to resolve this battle of the experts using solely a DCF analysis and determining that the fair value of Golden was $125.49 per share. That's $20 per share more than the transaction price, a difference of about $820 million, and more than double Golden's highest unaffected trading price of $61.23. In some cases, some appraisal cases, predicting the future is something unavoidable. We have to do it. This is not such a case, however. Here, prior to the merger, Golden had been publicly traded for about 10 years. Its stock was widely held and covered by numerous analysts. It was purchased by a third party after months of arm's-length negotiation with an independent special committee. Over 6 months elapsed before the first leak of the potential transaction and the closing of the deal. Notwithstanding the absence of structural impediments, no other bidder emerged during the six-month time frame. Under those circumstances, as acknowledged by the courts, experts, academics, practitioners, the best evidence of the value of Golden is what VimpelCom paid for it.
Well, doesn't the record reflect that two of the largest shareholders said they weren't going to support a different transaction?
Justice Holland, the way that played out.
First, let's start out whether the record reflects that.
The record reflects that at some point in time, both of the large stockholders acknowledged that they were not going to sell. And the way that played out was during the negotiations lasted from about July of 2007 till the end of December 2007.
Well, I don't want to use up all of your time, but I asked the question in response to your effort that no one else came forward. And in the vice chancellor's opinion, he said, well, it's unlikely anyone was going to come forward if they didn't have that support. And my question is that, in fact, what the vice chancellor concluded?
The vice chancellor did make that conclusion. We believe that is an unreasonable conclusion to draw, and I'll focus on why we believe that. In the vice chancellor assumed that Alpha and Telenor were not sellers. In most controlling stockholder situations, and we have to step back for a second and acknowledge that this is not a controlling stockholder case. VimpelCom, who was the acquirer, was not the controlling stockholder of Golden. In fact, VimpelCom didn't own any stock of Golden. What you had were two stockholders, Alpha and Telenor, who never acted in concert, and in fact, the record reflects, had a history of litigation against each other beginning in 2005 and continuing at the time of the transaction. They owned 45% of Golden. They also owned about 65% of VimpelCom. In the controlling stockholder paradigm, usually what you have is a situation where the controller says, I am a buyer and I am not a seller, and sends that signal to the market. Here, we did not have that. During the time of the negotiations, there were no public statements by Alpha or Telenor. The special committee did reach out and speak to Alpha and Telenor during the negotiation process. Alpha, which held about 26% of the stock, told the special committee in November that it was unlikely that they would sell to anybody else. They viewed this as a strategic asset. Telenor, on the other hand, was noncommittal. And in fact, what Telenor said is, we will entertain any offer that comes in the door. Even after the transaction was announced, Telenor didn't decide or announce what it was going to do. It filed a 13E3 on January 18th, which is almost a month after the deal was signed, said it had not yet made a decision. Didn't commit, announce that it was going to tender until February 5th, and only then after it conducted its own analysis. And we can look, there's real-world evidence that the market did not know what the position of these two stockholders was. And in fact, the real-world evidence is from the petitioners themselves. There is an email from January 28th, over 1 month after the signing of the deal. It's found in the appendix at A958. This is an internal email from the petitioners among the principal, the general counsel, and others. And they write, I got the sense that Telenor and Ross Telecom, who's another significant stockholder, are not a guarantee to tender their shares. It also says Telenor is officially neutral on the tender currently. So even petitioners did not know what the position of the large stockholders was as late as January 28th.
If we could, let's come back to the legal issues in this appeal. And your first argument is that the court should consider adopting some variation on a rule that gives great weight to the price that was negotiated here by your special committee. And as I understand it, the expert you presented came in with a valuation that was $20 below the negotiated price. Wouldn't you expect, one of two things could happen. They overpaid, you know, for a company that was really worth 85, they paid 105. And if that's not the case, wouldn't you expect to see a greater correlation between your expert's valuation and what was actually negotiated?
The difference between our expert's valuation and the negotiated price, less synergies, actually is not all that different. The negotiated price was $1.05 per share. Our expert came in at roughly $90 per share. Mm-hmm. The evidence in the record from VimpelCom's financial advisor itself and also from analysts who were following the transaction was that the anticipated synergies in the deal were approximately $11 to $12 per share. So if you take $105, subtract the $11 or $12, the number that our expert came up with, and that number is extremely close.
If I understand your position correctly, you're suggesting to us that we should adopt a form of rule that would have a conclusive presumption in favor of the market price or the negotiated price, or at least a rebuttable presumption that favors the market price. My question is, how do we do that when appraisal is entirely controlled by statute? How do we graft that kind of rule on the statute? Is there anything in the statute that would give us that flexibility?
I believe so, Chief Justice Steele. The statute entrusts the Court of Chancery and ultimately this court, to determine the fair value of the shares. And it, other than saying that it shall not take into account anything dealing with the accomplishment or expectation of the merger, the statute itself does not dictate how the company should be valued. And I think that this court and the Court of Chancery should be focused on using the approach that is best designed to get the right answer. This is a very uncertain area of the law.
Well, if you move in the direction of a presumption, how does that factor into our precedent that talks about the going concern value of the company at the time of the merger?
The way that factors into the precedent, Chief Justice Steele, is if you look at the academic literature, you look at the cases that this court and the Court of Chancery has decided, for example, the MPM Enterprises case. In that case, the court said that deference to market price is appropriate in certain circumstances. It's been said in the AXA case, the Union Illinois case, that the concept of deference is really not all that controversial if you look at the case law and the academic literature. Where it becomes controversial is when do you apply it. Going back to the MPM case, the MPM case noted that deference to market price would be appropriate in situations where it was reflective of the going concern value of the company.
Why isn't the market price simply one of the relevant considerations under the statutory scheme? You seem to want to, give it special consideration rather than simply being one of the relevant considerations.
It certainly is one of the relevant considerations, Justice Hollenmark. That's not a controversial proposition. We do believe that in particular circumstances, it makes sense to give it conclusive weight, presumptive weight, or as your Honor said, special weight.
Well, and how is that consistent with Weinberger that moved away from the Delaware block method and talked about all sorts of methods of valuation? The current process seems to be fairly flexible, open-ended, as the Chief Justice said. You get your proportionate value in the going concern based on everything that's known, not speculative, ascertainable. You take into account all relevant considerations. To adopt the approach you're advocating would be a real paradigm shift, wouldn't it?
I don't view it as quite such a shift, Your Honor. And the reason is, as I said, courts have repeatedly acknowledged that deference to market price is appropriate in certain circumstances. Debate about what those circumstances are.
Yeah, and if you look, as Justice Holland's question, I think, accurately points out, it's highly contextual. By way of example, at least in my mind, and moral with this if you like, a real auction process that results in a reflection of the market price would cause me as a vice chancellor to give more weight to the market price than a negotiated deal with one other party. I would be much more comfortable that eight potential bidders did their due diligence and went all out to top one another to achieve a final deal. That market price might more accurately reflect the going concern. But I think the reason that the flexibility exists as the statute contemplates it and as our case law discusses it is every context is different. You can't lock in a set rule for every possible situation. There are just too many variations on the common theme of trying to value the going concern. Now, would you, under your hypothesis, be more or less comfortable with a process that gave greater weight depending on the contextual circumstances rather than a hard and fast conclusive presumption or even rebuttable presumption?
What we're asking, Your Honor, I think there are a number of ways you could do it. A conclusive presumption, I agree, is an extremely strict rule. And it is one that I don't think is inappropriate, but may not be where this court wants to go. And I'm going to try to, I don't think I fully answered Justice Holland's questions. I'm going to try to answer both questions as I'm.
Well, answer his first, and then if you need to, after that, address mine.
But I'm certainly going to address yours, Chief Justice Steele.
He was first at the
one question you asked me, Justice Holland, was isn't this a real departure from Weinberger, when in Weinberger we abandoned the Delaware block method, which did set down a strict way of looking at this? And I don't think it is. What has always been a hallmark of this court is looking at what makes sense and trying to get to the right answer and trying to achieve some stability and predictability in the law. In 1983, when this court looked at Weinberger, it said, look, the Delaware block method is too rigid. You have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do that, and then you weight them. And what the courts, based on evidence from the academic and the financial world, that valuation was really much more flexible than that. This court said, we want to get it right. And the way to get it right is to allow valuation techniques that are generally accepted in the financial community. That's really all that I'm asking the court to do here. Look at the technique that best gets it right. And when you have a situation here where there has been arm's-length negotiations, opportunity for a topping bid, an efficient market, and no credible allegations of fiduciary duty, we believe that it is appropriate to defer to the market price, whether that's a conclusive presumption, a rebuttable presumption, or guidance to the Court of Chancery that in those circumstances you really should be looking at the market price and giving it, if not full weight, the majority of the weight, is an appropriate thing for this court to do. To answer Chief Justice Steele's question about the auction, does an auction give you more comfort? Certainly it could. But I don't believe that an auction is a prerequisite here. If you look at the AXA case decided by the Court of Chancery,
No, but doesn't the very fact you said it would give you more comfort suggest that locking in a presumption is a bad idea? Because there's so many variables in the weight that one would give at the end of the day to market price versus expert testimony versus assumptions made by the experts on the facts and so on.
I don't think it does, Chief Justice Steele, and I think one of the reasons for that is if you look at this court's entire jurisprudence, the court has always been focused on letting the board of directors who are elected by the stockholders decide what is the appropriate approach for selling the company, valuing the company, and we have never, in any case, required an auction, required what the Court of Chancery required below, that you go out to the significant stockholders and get a commitment from them and use that to shop the company. That's really what the court relied on below, saying you had to do this. You had to go out to Alpha and Telenor. And if because you didn't do that, I'm not going to give any weight to the transaction price.
But so did you want to save your rebuttal?
Yeah, I do, but I do want to finish your question.
I don't want to interrupt you. If you want to finish, go ahead.
So I think the rule that we're asking the court to impose, whether it's a conclusive presumption, a rebuttable presumption, or guidance to the court that this is really what you should be looking at in these circumstances, will go a long way to harmonizing the appraisal law with other areas of Delaware corporate law, and will also put an emphasis on getting the answer right. If you look at the arguments among the experts in this case, it really cries out for this court and the Court of Chancery to give deference to the market price. They argue about things that no one can know, and it's appropriate for this court to step in and say, under the circumstances that we have, deference to the transaction price is appropriate. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I was actually happy to hear this back and forth on the importance of the context in appraisal cases, because I don't think that there's any basis for a presumption to be read into the statute. The statute simply doesn't provide for it, and this court has held numerous times that under the appraisal statute, stockholders are entitled to an independent judicial determination of the value of the shares. But to say that doesn't mean that the concept of deference doesn't have its place in our appraisal law. Deference is exactly what we have in the Union in Illinois case and the AXA Financial case. But here's the question. What did the court focus on in those cases? It's a question of what is the inquiry. And I submit to the court that the inquiry is an economic inquiry, not a fiduciary duty-based inquiry. In Union Illinois, for example, the court was impressed with the fact that there were no conflicts of interest. There was a fair and open competitive auction. A large number of prospective buyers were contacted. The court was also influenced by the fact that the merger price was pretty substantial for a company that appeared to be on the brink of bankruptcy. AXA Financial, again, no inside buyer, and no structural impediments to somebody coming along. So I say that the inquiry should be on financial issues. If there's an auction, if with suitable knowledge a large number of potential buyers are contacted and there are no impediments, that gives the court comfort that the market actually did set the price, and the market may well be a better indication of value than simply getting down and trying to predict the future going through typical valuation techniques.
Well, the issue, at least in my mind, is the market will always set a price if there's a consummated deal. The question is, does that price, standing alone in a certain factual context, constitute the going concern value of the company?
That's right. And the court here found that it couldn't have comfort in that because no auction was run, nobody was contacted. You know, if you start to get into the fiduciary inquiry that they would like you to go down, you start to run afoul of a lot of things. You run afoul of the fact that the appraisal statute is designed to be a narrow statute focused on value. You run afoul of the many, many cases from our court, this court and the Court of Chancery, that have said that concepts of fiduciary wrongdoing should be excluded from an appraisal proceeding. You also begin to make things very, very expensive, and they're already expensive enough, because the inquiry then, if you bring fiduciary duty law into the mix, the inquiry isn't just were certain things done, like an auction or potential buyers contacted, so you have comfort that the price is a good indication of value. The inquiry has to go beyond as to why certain things weren't done. And that makes the appraisal case very, very expensive. I think the record here is pretty clear about why the vice chancellor could not possibly defer. You had a company that was performing well, almost zero debt, was performing well above its peers, wasn't even looking to be sold, but you, of course, had this large control group held 45%, and they wanted to go forward. So what happened? They appointed a special committee precisely because of the interested parties. Nobody was contacted. During the very first meeting with the investment potential, when they were interviewing investment banks, Credit Suisse, which was ultimately hired because of its specific knowledge of the market, identified potential buyers, was never asked to contact one of them. Nobody on the special committee made any effort to do it. They focused entirely on getting the best price from Vimpelcom. Mr. Gallagher, he admitted that, you know, a lot of the potential buyers would be in foreign markets, and it's not like the United States. You really don't have the wealth of information to know where particular companies are in their business plans, what their financials are like, whether or not they could be a potential buyer at all. He didn't even know where Vimpelcom itself was in its interest in getting in to the particular business, that the Wi-Fi business that Golden was in. So he really didn't have the type of knowledge you'd want to expect to forego any kind of search. And it's all of those things that made the vice chancellor very, very comfortable. They also avoided things like a majority of the minority vote. They referred to it as the kiss of death. And he, you know, if you wonder why, Mr. Gallagher, when I asked him about that, said he actually started to laugh and said he didn't know what he meant. That's a particular phrase, kiss of death. I would think that somebody would know what they mean when they say something like that. And it's right in the minutes from the very first meeting of the special committee. Here, you talk about the market. The stockholders received a fairness opinion that I think it's indisputable that the fairness opinion was inaccurate. It was off by $9. So they at least got a fairness opinion that they thought this was within a particular range, and the fairness opinion was off. If you want to talk about the price ultimately determined by the Court of Chancery here, $126, that's within the range of the fair price set forth in the fairness opinion, the uncorrected fairness opinion. If the fairness opinion is corrected, the range goes up another $9. It's $9 above what the price was here. So the biggest problem is, and this is what I think influenced the vice chancellor the most, he didn't say that they had to run an auction. He didn't tell them that they had to do particular things. What he acknowledged was, is you had a large holder here that publicly announced that they viewed this holding in Golden to be strategic and they would not sell. And that in light of the fact that they never ran an auction, nobody was ever contacted, the deal's announced, it's with a control group, What is a third party supposed to think about the interest of the company in selling? They tried to avoid publicly looking like there's an auction. And once that deal is announced, this is the problem with controlling stockholder transactions. Somebody to come along has to overpay just to get the value that somebody has locked up. Because it's one thing when you sit there as a large holder and you're not the buyer. You'll sell to whoever pay the highest price. But when you are on the buy side, if you sell to somebody who wants to pay a little bit more than you're offering, you lose the value that you capture by buying the minority at the discounted price. And that's just the nature of a controlling stockholder transaction. And that's why, you know, somebody's not going to sell. You know, if there are no interested parties, the concept of the whole market knowing what's going on is great. And in many cases, I think the Court of Chancery could defer because anybody is going to sell at higher price, but you're not going to sell at the higher price when you are a buyer and you want to capture the minority at a discount. I guess one comment I would make, the argument from the defendants appears to be, it's almost like I was hearing a post-trial argument. I didn't hear a lot about, you know, why the particular facts found by the court are not supported by the record. I think everything in the record that the court relied upon is clearly supported. And when you look at the process, if you just read the couple of pages from the cross-examination of Mr. Gallagher, you'll see exactly why the court could not get any comfort that the market price was a best indication of value. But the court didn't stop there. The court also looked at the market evidence. It's a very strange situation here. Every single time there was a merger price announcement related to this deal, the buyer's stock went up, not the seller's. It just doesn't happen. They also talk about, well, this ultimate appraisal determination was more than twice the value of what the company had ever traded at. Well, I would submit to you, if you look at, and we have, let me see if I can just make sure I get the pages right, exhibit or parts of the appendix like B348 and B346, where we go through the two-year history of VimpelCom, Golden Telecom, and their comparable company, Comstar. You will see that this company was growing at a rapid pace. It was outperforming the market. It was outperforming its competitors. And VimpelCom itself was doing the same thing. And so you can't simply look at isolation in the trading price and say, well, somehow the stock wouldn't have gone up that much when the company had a two-year history leading up to this deal of outperforming that market and in a growing sector, a sector that in the United States when it got started outpaced GDP by three times.
I take it you don't believe in an efficient market.
Your Honor, I am a big believer in an efficient market. The problem here is we didn't have an efficient market. There were things that, first of all, if you look at the stock price, our law recognizes in Travelocity that the stock trading price of stock reflects minority trades, so you'd put a control premium on that as well. That problem is exacerbated when you already have a large controlling stockholder. You had situations here. Mr. Gallagher admitted that he thought that VimpelCom itself was trying to suppress the stock price of Golden by leaking to the market a low price that would keep the market price down. So there were a lot of things going on here that you really can't look to what was going on in this particular market. But I'm a big believer in the efficient market, and I think the Court of Chancery ought to, when they can, rely upon an efficient market. We just didn't have one here.
Let's focus for a moment on the statute.
Yes.
I keep going back to the statute because this, in my view, is not an area for the common law to operate. We're either blessed by or cursed by the language of the statute, depending on your perspective. Where in the language of the statute do you believe the court has flexibility to impose a presumption of any kind or a greater weight to the market kind of analysis, greater weight to the market price or the deal price in the analysis of fair value?
I don't. I don't think there's any. The statute says that the Court of Chancery shall appraise shares and to take into consideration all relevant factors, excluding value attributable to accomplishment of the merger.
All right, that takes care of, from your perspective, the first two points
yes.
that your friends made. How about the third one, that there should be some direction from this court that under certain factual circumstances, apparently consistent with the ones found here, there should be some instruction from us to the Court of Chancery that greater weight should be given to the deal price than in other circumstances in their overall analysis. Is there room within the language of the statute for us to suggest that to the Court of Chancery?
Your Honor, there's room within the language of the statute to suggest it, not to impose it anyway in any type of presumption. That's all
Where would you draw the line? I attempted, probably ineffectively, to say or suggest I might be more comfortable in an auction situation with saying that would be a factual context in which one might be more comfortable with the deal price accurately reflecting fair value or the company's going concern value. But anything short of that, where do you draw the line?
Well, I guess this gets back to the point that I was trying to make, and that is I agree that everyone would love to be able to defer. It makes it much easier if there's an efficient market. But I think if this court wants to provide guidance to the Court of Chancery, I think the court ought to stress that the inquiry under those circumstances, when the court is taking into consideration all relevant factors in determining the fair value of the company, that the inquiry needs to be on financial issues or particular financial techniques followed that are likely to give the court comfort that the market set the price. Things that we know work, an auction, contacting selected buyers with knowledge.
Help me understand the logic of that. If the appraisal statute calls for an independent judicial determination of the value of the company after the market has acted, if we are assuming the market acted efficiently, then that seems to be inconsistent with your right to an appraisal to have an independent judicial evaluation. It would seem, while it could be a factor, it can't be given weight, significant weight, because it undermines the whole premise that notwithstanding what the market did, there ought to be an independent judicial determination.
I agree with everything you said, Justice Holland. I think that's why you can't read a presumption into it. I do think that there are circumstances where, if a particular process is followed, the court's focus is on value. For example, the court says, geez, there was an auction. There was no controlling stockholder. The price was $100. And now I go through. I think the court still must do an independent valuation. That, I believe, I don't think a court could look at the process, say I'm comfortable that the process set the price, and never do the independent valuation. I think the statute requires the court to conduct an independent valuation. I do think the court might say, because these things are forward-looking and they're a little bit speculative, if my DCF gives me 101 and the market set 99, you know, I'm more inclined to lean with the market than I am to go into the speculative nature of a valuation. But that's simply just not this case. There's no reason here at all to give any credence to the market price because so many things were not done. I mean, not a single it borders on a breach of fiduciary duty when your financial advisor identifies and you say no. The chairman of the special committee admitted during trial, under questioning from the vice chancellor himself, that other potential buyers were not contacted precisely because of the control group. I think that ends the inquiry right there. The necessary things weren't done so that you could have any confidence in the process.
But you didn't want us to focus on the fiduciary duty issues. You want us to focus on the economic issues.
That's right. I want you to focus.
Weren't you just focusing on the fiduciary duty aspects?
I said as it came close, yes. But what I'm saying, I focused on a valuation issue, the type of things that were not done in this case that could give anyone comfort that the market in any way was any indication of the value of this company. Because no one's going to come along when a inside deal is announced, and they know that that deal resulted from no auction and nobody ever being contacted. Nobody's going to ever think this company is interested in selling to anybody else. How are they going to get it to be sold when 26% holder won't sell? And now that the deal's locked up, you almost have to overpay to get that 26% holder to give up their interest because they're losing the ability to capture the minority at a discount. All these things are reasons why the vice chancellor's decision was not just sound, certainly doesn't even come close to an abuse of discretion, which is the standard here. If I may, I'd like to touch, there are a couple of other issues related to value in this appeal. The equity risk premium. They say that we never identified any sort of source that contains 6%. That's just simply inaccurate. The DiMarzo book, which is taught at multiple business schools throughout this country, teaches 6%. The Harvard faculty mandates it. It's not like if you teach at the Harvard Business School, you must teach a 6% equity risk premium. So what?
But I thought their response to that was, while that's a fact, there doesn't seem to be any analysis of how they reached that conclusion.
They looked at all the data at the time. Here's what everything to be considered tells us. It's below 6%. Fama French is 4.5. I'll stipulate to Pratt right now that this court has looked to for years as a valuation expert. He says 5%. All of the data tells us that the number is likely to be below 6. That's why the court was comfortable that the 6% was on the conservative side, because we could have argued for a much lower number that would have driven this valuation up significantly. What they're arguing for is the historical number, and everybody agrees history will not repeat itself. The only way the historical number is accurate is if you take history and you flip it, and it's going to automatically repeat itself going forward. Everybody agrees that's simply not going to happen. So investment banks are using ones that are even lower, 3.5 to 4%. We cited all of this in our brief. So there's ample support for the court's judgment of accepting a 6% equity risk premium, because the only other way the court could go would be the other way. I'm content to rely upon what we said about the terminal growth rate in our briefs, because I don't want to give short shrift to our appellate issues. This tax rate in the fairness opinion, which is our issue, again, I think we said a lot in our briefs, but I do want to stress a couple of things. An appraisal petitioner has to be able to rely upon company-specific data in a fairness opinion. While they claim they're not trying to disavow their data, that's exactly what they're doing. Projections, cost of debt, tax rate. The financial advisor gets that from the company and works with the company on that. What happened here was, we're not saying we're entitled to rely upon what Credit Suisse sent to us. The company itself took the fairness opinion, presumably reviewed it, thought it was accurate, looked at it. They attached it to their proxy statement, arguing to the stockholders that this deal was fair and asking them to support the deal. What they did was governed by the duty of candor, and the SEC filing was governed by the federal securities laws. Stockholders have to be able to rely upon that kind of company-specific information. We're not talking about, we're always going to be debates about these forward-looking valuation inputs, equity risk premium, terminal growth rate, beta, all those things. But the actual hard information, the company data, a stockholder has to be able to rely upon. And I'll make this point. On page 40 of our first brief filed, we cite the Polygon case. And in Polygon, the Court of Chancery denied Section 220 inspection rights because the stockholder wanted financial information to decide to do an analysis of whether or not they ought to pursue appraisal. And in speaking about the significance of the SEC disclosures, the court said, this wealth of detailed information would appear to satisfy the obligation to disclose all facts material to the decision whether or not to demand appraisal.
Have you run the numbers? If your position on the tax rate prevails in your cross appeal, have you quantified that?
Yeah, it's $1.20 a share. Approximately. If we're wrong.
So you'd go up above the appraisal by $1.20.
$1.20. It would add $1.20 a share. If we are wrong on this issue, the Polygon case has to be wrong. Because if we're wrong, that means any time there's a public company merger, a stockholder is going to have per se 220 inspection rights on valuation issues in order to decide whether or not to pursue appraisal or not.
And for this issue, what's your position on the standard of review? Is this, as a matter of law, the Court of Chancery got it wrong, or was this an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, I see my time beyond. May I? I think this is a pure legal question as to whether or not the duty of candor, the federal securities laws, entitle a stockholder to rely upon the company-specific information. Because it's a real problem if you're telling them they can't get inspection rights, and then when they do pursue their appraisal, they say, oh, no, the company now can walk away from the company-specific data. I don't know how they can disavow their own data. That's exactly what Vice Chancellor Lamb wrote Polygon, and he outwrote Cytokine. In Cytokine, he said it would be wrong to allow a company to disavow its own data in order to justify a lower valuation in an appraisal case. I think that's the situation here. I think it's exceedingly unfair. They sent it out. Presumably it was accurate.
Okay, the question was whether, what's the standard of review? Have you answered that?
I think de novo, because I think that's a pure legal question.
What you're saying with that answer is that as a matter of law, when the Court of Chancery is doing an appraisal, they must use the data that was sent out by the company.
Not that they must use it, that the company, as a matter of law, unless they can establish that it was inaccurate and the SEC filing should have been corrected, that the company itself can't walk away from that data.
All right, so it's an estoppel type of argument.
Absolutely. I think a stockholder could argue that maybe when they get into discovery, they could see that the projections may have been toned down, but they ought not be able to change the direction the other way on evaluation. Thank you.
Your Honors, Mr. Reed pointed out in his argument that we haven't focused on any errors of the Court of Chancery. Our briefs go through the errors in detail. I do want to focus on one, which I think is probably the biggest error. And the biggest error is that the Court made the assumption that Alpha and Telenor provided a structural impediment to a higher bid. And we think that is an unreasonable inference to draw. We talked about the history of what they said and when they said it. But also, it's important to focus on the fact that prior to the deal being signed on December 21st, there was a leak in July that there were negotiations going on. There was another leak in October regarding Vimpelcom trying to get a credit facility in place to do the acquisition. On December 3rd, there was a public announcement by Vimpelcom and Golden that a deal had been struck at 105, but they still had to work out the terms of the merger agreement. At no time, before or after the deal, did a third party come in. There was a 2% termination fee. There was a fiduciary out. There were no matching rights, and this is one thing I want to point out. In the opinion, the Court indicated on page 15 that there were matching rights in the merger agreement. That is a mistake. I've spoken with Mr. Reed. He agrees that it's a mistake. The source that he relies on, A553, clearly indicates that it was a mistake. There were no structural impediments here. This was clearly an example of textbook arm's-length negotiations. The special committee got the price from 80 to 105. We believe that 105 less synergies is the best evidence of the going concern value of this company.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.